Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Sod 2, For the Record, program number 670, Update on the Meltdown, Part 3, subtitled Top Banana Republic. This program is being recorded on April 19th of the year 2009. This program consists largely of the reading of an article from the May 2009 issue of The Atlantic. The article is by a former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. His name is Simon Johnson. The article is called The Quiet Coup. And what he is talking about here is the tremendous power in the American economic and consequently political landscapes of what he terms the oligarchs, and specifically the investment business and the financial sector, have assumed a tremendous and, in recent times, unprecedented influence within the government. It is his contention, and this is what the Top Banana Republic subtitle refers to, it is his contention that what the United States currently faces is very similar to the type of oligarch slash elite slash crony capitalist dominated economies that he has seen only too often in his work for the International Monetary Fund. And it is his contention that the only way that countries that are in financial crisis in emerging markets, in the realm of emerging markets, have been able to right the ship, so to speak, is by squeezing some of these oligarchs and basically reforming the entire political and economic system. And the IMF will not lend to them until or unless this happens. And it is the contention of Simon Johnson that the U.S. is in precisely the same straits and that we are in very, very perilous waters indeed. When we concluded Side 2, we were talking about not only the tremendous political influence that is generated by the revolving door of people moving from positions with investment banks or private funds and moving into the corridors of power and the corridors of regulatory power in Washington, D.C. He was also, that is to say, Simon Johnson was also talking about how many works that were intended to alert people to the dangers of this kind of thing actually helped to reinforce the mystique of this in the minds of the public, with things like individual retirement accounts and 401k programs placing a larger and larger number of Americans into the investment field, so to speak. Their largesse, their well-being is dependent on the investment climate. It is given that has helped to give the lords of finance, so to speak, a tremendous influence within the government, and it also places a large number of Americans at peril if indeed the system continues to disintegrate. And it is Simon Johnson's contention that so far we have not seen what has to take place. The oligarchs have to be squeezed. He feels that banks should be nationalized. By the way, Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize winning economist and syndicated columnist with the New York Times, feels the same way. He's very critical of Obama's program. And it is the belief of Simon Johnson that if we do not do what many of these emerging markets countries have been obliged to do, then we are basically screwed, and that we are likely to see something, no, not as bad as the Great Depression, ladies and gentlemen, something worse than the Great Depression. And so it is in that spirit and with that caveat and look forward that I'm going to begin, that I'm going to resume with the reading of this very important article. Again, the article is authored by Simon Johnson, a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. It is in the May 2009 issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called The Quiet Coup. And the reference, of course, is to the basic appropriation, very quietly, of inordinate economic power by elements of the investment industry. And talking about the Washington Wall Street revolving door in the corridors of power, Simon Johnson goes on to comment, "From this confluence of campaign finance, personal connections, and ideology, there flowed in just the past decade a river of deregulatory policies that is, in hindsight, astonishing. Insistence on free movement of capital across borders. the repeal of Depression-era regulations separating commercial and investment banking, a congressional ban on the regulation of credit default swaps, major increases in the amount of leverage allowed to investment banks, a light, dare I say, invisible hand at the Securities and Exchange Commission in its regulatory enforcement, an international agreement to allow banks to measure their own riskiness, and an intentional failure to update regulations so as to keep up with the tremendous pace of financial innovation. The mood that accompanied these measures in Washington seemed to swing between nonchalance and outright celebration. Finance unleashed, it was thought, would continue to propel the economy to greater and greater heights. And the next section of the article is termed by Simon Johnson, America's Oligarchs and the Financial Crisis. Simon Johnson writes, "The oligarchy and the government policies that aided it did not alone cause the financial crisis that exploded last year. Many other factors contributed, including excessive borrowing by households and lax lending standards out on the fringes of the financial world. But major commercial and investment banks and the hedge funds that ran alongside them were the big beneficiaries of the twin housing and equity market bubbles of this decade. Their profits, fed by an ever-increasing volume of transactions, founded on a relatively small base of actual physical assets. Each time a loan was sold, packaged, securitized, and resold, banks took their transaction fees, and the hedge funds buying those securities reaped ever larger fees as their holdings grew. Because everyone was getting richer, and the health of the national economy depended so heavily on growth in real estate and finance, no one in Washington had any incentive to question what was going on. Instead, Fed Chairman Greenspan and President Bush insisted metronomically that the economy was fundamentally sound and that the tremendous growth in complex securities and credit default swaps was evidence of a healthy economy where risk was distributed safely. In the summer of 2007, signs of strain started appearing. The boom had produced so much debt that even a small economic stumble could cause major problems, and rising delinquencies in subprime mortgages proved to be the stumbling block. Ever since, the financial sector and the federal government have been behaving exactly the way one would expect them to in light of past emerging market crises. By now, the princes of the financial world have, of course, been stripped naked as leaders and strategists, at least in the eyes of most Americans. But as the months have rolled by, financial elites have continued to assume that their position as the economy's favored children is safe, despite the enormous wreckage they've caused. Stanley O'Neill, the CEO of Merrill Lynch, pushed his firm heavily into the mortgage-backed securities market at its peak in 2005 and 2006. In October of 2007, he acknowledged, quote, "The bottom line is I got it wrong by being overexposed to subprime, and we suffered as a result of impaired liquidity in that market. No one is more disappointed than I am in that result," unquote. O'Neill took home a $14 million bonus in 2006. In 2007, he walked away from Merrill Lynch with a severance package worth $162 million, although it is presumably worth much less today. In October of 2008, John Thain, Merrill Lynch's final CEO, reportedly lobbied his board of directors for a bonus of $30 million or more, eventually reducing his demand to $10 million in December. He withdrew the request under a firestorm of protest only after it was leaked to the Wall Street Journal. Merrill Lynch as a whole was no better. It moved its bonus payments, $4 billion in total, forward to December, presumably to avoid the possibility that they would be reduced by Bank of America, which would own Merrill Lynch beginning on January 1st. Wall Street paid out $18 billion in year-end bonuses last year to its New York City employees, after the government dispersed $243 billion in emergency assistance to the financial sector. In a financial panic, the government must respond with both speed and overwhelming force. The root problem is uncertainty. In our case, uncertainty about whether the major banks have sufficient assets to cover their liabilities. Half measures combined with wishful thinking and a wait-and-see attitude cannot overcome this uncertainty. And the longer the response takes, the longer that uncertainty will stymie the flow of credit sap consumer confidence and cripple the economy, ultimately making the problem much harder to solve. Yet, the principal characteristics of the government's response to the financial crisis have been delay, lack of transparency, and an unwillingness to upset the financial sector. The response so far is perhaps best described as policy by deal, unquote. When a major financial institution gets into trouble, the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve engineer a bailout over the weekend and announce on Monday that everything is fine. In March of 2008, Bear Stearns was sold to J.P. Morgan Chase in what looked to many like a gift to J.P. Morgan. Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan's CEO, sits on the board of directors at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which, along with the Treasury Department, brokered that deal. In September, we saw the sale of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America, the first bailout of AIG, and the takeover and immediate sale of Washington Mutual to J.P. Morgan, all of which were brokered by the government. In October, nine large banks were recapitalized on the same day behind closed doors in Washington. This, in turn, was followed by additional bailouts for Citigroup, AIG, Bank of America, Citigroup again, and AIG again. Some of these deals may have been reasonable responses to the immediate situation, but it was never clear, and still isn't, what combination of interests was being served and how. Treasury and the Fed did not act according to any publicly articulated principles, but just worked out a transaction and claimed it was the best that could be done under the circumstances. This was late night, backroom dealing, pure and simple. Throughout the crisis, the government has taken extreme care not to upset the interests of the financial institutions or to question the basic outlines of the system that got us here. In September of 2008, Henry Paulson asked Congress for $700 billion to buy toxic assets from banks with no strings attached and no judicial review of his purchase decisions. Many observers suspected that the purpose was to overpay for those assets and thereby take the problem off the bank's hands. Indeed, that is the only way that buying toxic assets would have helped anything. Perhaps because there was no way to make such a blatant subsidy politically acceptable, that plan was shelved. Instead, the money was used to recapitalize banks, buying shares in them on terms that were grossly favorable to the banks themselves. As the crisis has deepened and financial institutions have needed more help, the government has gotten more and more creative in figuring out ways to provide banks with subsidies that are too complex for the general public to understand. The first AIG bailout, which was on relatively good terms for the taxpayer, was supplemented by three further bailouts whose terms were more AIG-friendly. The second Citigroup bailout and the Bank of America bailout included complex asset guarantees that provided the banks with insurance at below-market rates. The third Citigroup bailout in late February converted government-owned preferred stock to common stock at a price that was significantly higher than the market price, a subsidy that probably even most Wall Street Journal readers would miss on first reading. And the convertible preferred shares that Treasury will buy under the new financial stability plan give the conversion option, and thus the upside, to the banks, not the government. By the way, when we're reading the government here, fill in yourself, i.e. the taxpayers. That's really what's being said here. Continuing now with Simon Johnson's article, The Quiet Coup. This latest plan, which is likely to provide cheap loans to hedge funds and others so that they can buy distressed bank assets at relatively high prices, has been heavily influenced by the financial sector, and Treasury has made no secret of that. As Neil Kashkari, a senior Treasury official under both Henry Paulson and Tim Geithner, and himself a former Goldman Sachs alum, told Congress in March, quote, "We had received inbound, unsolicited proposals from people in the private sector saying, we have capital on the sidelines. We want to go after distressed bank assets," unquote. And the plan lets them do just that. Quote, "By marrying government capital, taxpayer capital with private sector capital and providing financing, you can enable those investors to then go after those assets at a price that makes sense for the investors and at a price that makes sense for the banks, unquote. Kashkari didn't mention anything about what makes sense for the third group who was involved, the taxpayers. Even leaving aside fairness to taxpayers, the government's velvet glove approach with the banks is deeply troubling for one simple reason. It is inadequate to change the behavior of a financial sector accustomed to doing business on its own terms at a time when that behavior must change. As an unnamed senior bank official said to the New York Times last fall, quote, "It doesn't matter how much Hank Paulson gives us, no one is going to lend a nickel until the economy turns," unquote. But here's the rub. The economy can't recover until the banks are healthy and willing to lend. The next section of Simon Johnson's article, rather, is called The Way Out. Looking just at the financial crisis and leaving aside some problems of the larger economy, we face at least two major and interrelated problems. The first is a desperately ill banking sector that threatens to choke off any incipient recovery that the fiscal stimulus might generate. The second is a political balance of power that gives the financial sector a veto over public policy, even as that sector loses popular support. Big banks, it seems, have only gained political strength since the crisis began, and that's not surprising. With the financial system so fragile, the damage that a major bank failure would cause, Lehman was small relative to Citigroup or Bank of America, is much greater than it would be during ordinary times. The banks have been exploiting this fear as they wring favorable deals out of Washington. Bank of America, for example, obtained its second bailout package in January after warning the government that it might not be able to go through with the acquisition of Merrill Lynch, a prospect that the Department of Treasury did not want to consider. The challenges the United States faces are familiar territory to the people at the International Monetary Fund. If you hid the name of the country and just showed them the numbers, there is no doubt what old IMF hands would say. Nationalize troubled banks and break them up as necessary. In some ways, of course, the government has already taken control of the banking system. It has essentially guaranteed the liabilities of the biggest banks, and it is their only plausible source of capital today. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve has taken on a major role in providing credit to the economy, the function that the private banking sector is supposed to be performing but isn't. Yet there are limits to what the Fed can do on its own. Consumers and businesses are still dependent on banks that lack the balance sheets and the incentives to make the loans the economy needs, and the government has no real control over who runs the banks or over what they do. At the root of the bank's problems are the large losses they have undoubtedly taken on their securities and loans portfolios. But they don't want to recognize the full extent of their losses because that would likely expose them as being insolvent. So they talk down the problem and ask for handouts that aren't enough to make them healthy. Again, they can't reveal the size of the handouts that would be necessary for that, but are enough to keep them upright just a little bit longer. This behavior is corrosive. Unhealthy banks either don't lend, hoarding money to shore up reserves, or they make desperate gambles on high-risk loans and investments that could pay off big, but probably won't pay off at all. In either case, the economy suffers further, and as it does, bank assets themselves continue to deteriorate, creating a highly destructive, vicious circle. To break this cycle, the government must force the banks to acknowledge the scale of their problems. As the IMF understands, and as the U.S. government itself has insisted to multiple emerging market countries in the past, the most direct way to do this is nationalization. Indeed, Treasury is trying to negotiate bailouts bank by bank, and behaving as if the banks hold all the cards, contorting the terms of each deal to minimize government ownership while forswearing government influence over bank strategy or operations. Under these conditions, cleaning up banks' balance sheets is impossible. Nationalization does not imply permanent state ownership. The IMF's advice would be essentially scale up the standard Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation process. An FDIC, quote, intervention, unquote, is basically a government-managed bankruptcy procedure for banks. It would allow the government to wipe out bank shareholders, replace failed management, clean up the balance sheets, and then sell the banks back to the private sector. The main advantage is immediate recognition of the problem so that it can be solved before it grows worse. The government needs to inspect the balance sheets and identify the banks that cannot survive a severe recession. These banks should face a choice. Either write down your assets to their true value and raise private capital within 30 days, or be taken over by the government. The government would write down the toxic assets of banks taken into receivership, recognizing reality, and then transfer those assets to a separate government entity which would attempt to salvage whatever value is possible for the taxpayer, as the Resolution Trust Corporation did after the savings and loan debacle over the 1980s. The rump banks, cleansed and able to lend safely and hence trusted again by other lenders and investors, could then be sold off. Cleaning up the mega banks will be complex, and it will be expensive for the taxpayer. According to the latest IMF numbers, the cleanup of the banking system would probably cost close to $1.5 trillion, or 10% of our GDP in the long term. But only such decisive government action, exposing the full extent of the financial rot and restoring some set of banks to publicly verifiable health, can cure the financial sector as a whole. This may seem like strong medicine, but in fact, while necessary, it is itself insufficient. The second problem the U.S. faces, the power of the oligarchy, is just as important as the immediate crisis of lending. And the advice from the IMF on this front would again be simple. Break the oligarchy. Oversized institutions disproportionately influence public policy. The major banks we have today draw much of their power from being too big to fail. Nationalization and reprivatization would not change that. While the replacement of the bank executives who got us into this crisis would be just and sensible, ultimately the swapping out of one set of powerful managers for another would change only the names of the oligarchs. Ideally, big banks would be sold in medium-sized pieces, divided regionally or by type of business. Where this proves to be impractical, since we'll want to sell the banks quickly, they could be sold whole, but with the requirement of being broken up within a short time. Banks that remain in private hands should also be subject to size limitations. This may seem like a crude and arbitrary step, but it is the best way to limit the power of individual institutions in a sector that is essential to the economy as a whole. Of course, some people will complain about the efficiency costs, unquote, of a more fragmented banking system, and these costs are real. But so are the costs when a bank that is too big to fail, a financial weapon of mass self-destruction, explodes. Anything that is too big to fail is too big to exist in the first place. To ensure systematic bank breakup and to prevent the eventual reemergence of dangerous behemoths, we also need to overhaul our antitrust legislation. Laws put in place more than 100 years ago to combat industrial monopolies were not designed to address the problems we now face. The problem in the financial sector today is not that a given firm might have enough market share to influence prices. It is that one firm or a small set of interconnected firms, by failing, can bring down the economy. The Obama administration's fiscal stimulus evokes FDR, but what we need to imitate here is Teddy Roosevelt's trust busting. Caps on executive compensation, while redolent of populism, might help restore the political balance of power and deter the emergence of a new oligarchy. Wall Street's main attraction to the people who work there and to the government officials who were only too happy to bask in its reflected glory has been the astounding amount of money that could be made. Limiting that money would reduce the allure of the financial sector and make it more like any other industry. Still, outright pay caps are clumsy, especially in the long run. And most money is now made in large, unregulated private hedge funds and private equity firms, so lowering pay would be complicated. Regulation and taxation should be part of the solution. Over time, though, the largest part may involve more transparency and competition, which would bring financial industry fees back down. To those who say this would drive financial activities to other countries, we can now safely say, fine. The next section and the concluding section of the article is called Two Paths. To paraphrase Joseph Schumpeter, the early 20th century economist, everyone has elites. The important thing is to change them from time to time. If the U.S. were just another country coming to the IMF with hat in hand, I might be fairly optimistic about its future. Most of the emerging market crises that I've mentioned ended relatively quickly and gave way, for the most part, to relatively strong recoveries. But this, alas, brings us to the limit of the analogy between the U.S. and emerging markets. Emerging market countries have only a precarious hold on wealth and are weaklings globally. When they get into trouble, they quite literally run out of money, or at least out of foreign currency, without which they can't survive. They must make difficult decisions. Ultimately, aggressive action is baked into the cake. But the U.S., of course, is the world's most powerful nation, rich beyond measure and blessed with the exorbitant privilege of paying its foreign debts in its own currency, which it can print. As a result, it could very well stumble along for years, as Japan did during its lost decade, never summoning the courage to do what it needs to do and never really recovering. A clean break with the past involving the takeover and cleanup of major banks hardly looks like a sure thing right now. Certainly, no one at the IMF can force it. In my view, the U.S. faces two plausible scenarios. The first involves complicated bank-by-bank deals and a continual drumbeat of repeated bailouts like the ones we saw in February with Citigroup and AIG. The administration will try to muddle through and confusion will reign. Boris Fyodorov, the late finance minister of Russia, struggled for most of the past 20 years against oligarchs, corruption, and abuse of authority in all its forms. He liked to say that confusion and chaos were very much in the interests of the powerful, letting them take things legally and illegally with impunity. When inflation is high, who can say what a piece of property is really worth? When the credit system is supported by Byzantine government arrangements and backroom deals, how do you know that you aren't being fleeced? One future could be one in which continued tumult feeds the looting of the financial system, and we talk more and more about exactly how our oligarchs became bandits and how the economy just can't seem to get into gear. The second scenario begins more bleakly and might end that way too, but it does provide at least some hope that we'll be able to be shaken out of our torpor. It goes like this. The global economy continues to deteriorate, the banking system in East Central Europe collapses, and because Eastern Europe's banks are mostly owned by Western European banks, justifiable fears of government insolvency spread throughout the continent. Creditors take further hits and confidence falls further, the Asian economies that export manufactured goods are devastated, and the commodity producers in Latin America and Africa are not much better off. A dramatic worsening of the global environment forces the U.S. economy already staggering down onto both knees. The baseline growth rates used in the administration's current budget are increasingly seen as unrealistic, and the rosy stress scenario that the U.S. Treasury is currently using to evaluate banks' balance sheets becomes a source of great embarrassment. Under this kind of pressure and faced with the prospect of a national and global collapse, minds may become more concentrated. The conventional wisdom among the elite is still that the current slump cannot be as bad as the Great Depression, unquote. This view is wrong. What we now face could in fact be worse than the Great Depression because the world is now so much more interconnected and because the banking sector is now so big. We face a synchronized downturn in almost all countries, a weakening of confidence among individuals and firms, and major problems for government finances. If our leadership wakes up to the potential consequences, we may yet see dramatic action on the banking system and a breaking of the old elite. Let us hope it is not then too late. This concludes For the Record program number 670, Side 2. Update on the meltdown, Part 3, Top Banana Republic, being recorded on April 19th of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.